Welcome back. This is a lecture on heuristics. A heuristic is a rule of thumb, like you should always have 3 to 6 months' pay in the bank in case of emergency, or to approximate a 15% tip, double the sales tax. Heuristics are guides to actions that are simpler and cruder than a complete calculation or a logical examination of all the possibilities. Simpler, cruder, and faster. Albert Einstein published a paper in 1905 entitled On a Heuristic Point of View Concerning the Generation and Transformation of Light. He used that title to indicate that the approach in the paper was sketchy and incomplete, maybe even false by the lights of a complete theory, but useful nonetheless. That's what heuristics are like. In this lecture, I want to introduce you to heuristics that can be simpler, cruder, faster, and just as good or even better than a complete rational calculation. Some of these heuristics seem to generate knowledge from ignorance in an almost magical way. In the phrase used by Gerd Gigerenzer, the German psychologist who did much of the background research, these are simple heuristics that make us smart. Simple heuristics also come with a warning label, however. While they're often useful, they're not guaranteed. Calculating a 15% tip by doubling the sales tax only works if the tax rate is 7.5%. Let's start with a simple but obscure question. Which city has a larger population, San Diego or San Antonio? That question was posed to two groups of students, to students at the University of Chicago and to students at the University of Munich. Who do you think did better? The University of Chicago students are a smart bunch, and of course, they're American. 62% of them got the answer right. San Diego has the larger population. What about the Germans? This may surprise you. 100% of the German students got the question right. All of them said that San Diego was larger. How could that be? Are the German students better informed about American demographics than University of Chicago students? No, in fact, they generally know significantly less about American cities and their population. 100% of the German students got the answer right, despite the fact that they know less about American cities. In fact, they got the answer right precisely because they know less. The German students seem to have used this heuristic, this rule of thumb. I've certainly heard of San Diego. I'm not sure I've heard of San Antonio. That must be because San Diego is a more prominent city. That probably means it's larger. Which has the larger population? I'll go with San Diego. This is a recognition heuristic. In general, you're asked about the value of two objects, whatever value, size of population, number of department stores, tax revenues, it doesn't matter. If you recognize one of them and not the other, pick the one you recognize as having the higher value. The German students could use that heuristic because they had a significantly clearer recognition of the one city than the other. They used their ignorance to good effect. The Chicago students didn't have that advantage. They didn't have that valuable ignorance. They were familiar with both San Diego and San Antonio, and so perhaps had to fall back on thinking of the position of the cities on a map, or San Diego is near the ocean and probably crowded with suburbs. San Antonio has lots of space. Things in Texas are always bigger. That's why only 62% of the Chicago students ended up with the right answer. Recognition is a fast and frugal heuristic. It's frugal because it works with extremely limited information. In fact, it demands that your information be extremely limited. Let's try you on the recognition heuristic. So here are two German cities. Which do you think has the larger population? Munich, Berlin. Do you have that? If you said Berlin is larger, perhaps because it's more familiar, you're right. The more detailed we get, the riskier it is. But let me try you on one more. Here are five German cities. How would you rank them in terms of population? Stuttgart, Bremen, Cologne, Berlin, Munich. If you're like me, you don't really know anything about relative population sizes. But if we list them in terms of recognition, they might go like this. Berlin, Munich, Cologne, Stuttgart, Bremen. That is, in fact, their order in terms of population size. Of course, this rule of thumb also has important limitations. Will it always work? No. A recognition heuristic works only when there is a real correlation behind it. A correlation between familiarity and population size, for example. When you don't have any further information, that correlation can sometimes be a good bet. It's interesting that it demands limited knowledge of the topic in order for this to work. If you know too much, you can't use it. So suppose you have three groups of people. One's extremely knowledgeable about the issue. One knows about half that much. One group is totally ignorant. For some questions, because of the recognition heuristic, it's the middle group that'll do the best. Those who know absolutely nothing can't use it. They don't recognize any of the alternatives. Those who know too much can't use it. They recognize them all. It's those in the middle who recognize some but not all of the alternatives who can put the heuristic to work effectively. The group that ran the experiment with German and American students put the results to the test by gauging success on the stock market. They made a list of companies from the New York Stock Exchange and from several German exchanges. They asked four groups of people to indicate which stocks they recognized. The four groups: American experts on the stock market, German experts, American lay people — they actually used pedestrians off the street — and German lay people. They asked each group, which of these companies do you recognize? German lay people recognized German companies like Allianz AG, Daimler-Benz, and Siemens, for example. U.S. lay people recognized U.S. companies like Amoco, Chrysler, Maytag, Sears Roebuck. Both groups recognized Lufthansa. Experts on each side, of course, recognized more. The experimenters then put together mock portfolios of the stocks recognized by over 90% of each group. They made a portfolio of the German stocks that German lay people recognized, a portfolio of German stocks that German experts recognized, similarly for Americans and American stocks. They also made a portfolio of American stocks that German lay people recognized, and one of American stocks that German experts recognized, and similarly for Americans. So, eight different pretend stock portfolios. They then tracked how well each did compared with the market index and mutual funds. Could it actually be possible that mere recognition beats the stock market index? When it comes to bets across borders, the answer is yes. Take the recognition portfolio of American lay people on German stocks. That did better than both mutual funds and the market index. It even did a little better than the portfolio of German stocks based on recognition by American experts. Returns for German lay people and German experts on American stocks did better than either the market index or mutual funds. When the bets were on stocks within countries, the results were mixed. German lay people and German experts still did better by recognition alone. American lay people and American experts betting on American stocks didn't. That was the only area in which the recognition heuristic lost. Maybe Americans weren't ignorant enough to use it. Maybe they knew too much. The portfolios constructed of stocks recognized by experts didn't do particularly well. That doesn't mean they didn't know their stuff. It's natural that the experts will recognize more stocks, both good and bad. But there are plenty of cases in which the experts do turn out to be wrong. Harry Warner was one of the founding brothers of Warner Brothers. But in 1927, just as movies changed from silent to sound, he predicted that movies with sound would be a flop. Who the hell wants to hear actors talk? In 1943, Thomas Watson, the father of IBM, said, "I think there's a world market for maybe five computers." Niels Bohr defined an expert as a man who has made all the mistakes which can be made in a very narrow field. Carl Sandburg characterized an expert as a damn fool a long way from home. What we need to be able to do is to tell the real experts, those who actually know, from the so-called experts. The suspicion is that many so-called experts may not, in fact, be particularly knowledgeable. Real experts are going to be those who really do know, but it may be hard to pick those out. This next heuristic indicates that you may not need to know who the real experts are. This is the rule of thumb known as the wisdom of crowds. Sir Francis Galton was a distinguished British scientist. He also happened to be a cousin of Charles Darwin. Galton is remembered positively for his studies of heredity and intelligence. He's remembered negatively for founding eugenics. Galton was convinced that some people are inherently smarter than others. He thought we should breed the smart ones and prevent reproduction by the dumb ones. He considered the intelligence of the general public to be deplorable. That fact about Galton makes this next case particularly interesting. In the fall of 1906, the 85-year-old Galton attended the annual West of England Fat Stock and Poultry Exhibition. They had a weight judging competition. A prize ox was put on display, and people put wagers on how much the ox weighed, or more precisely, how much it would weigh after it had been butchered and dressed. You bought a ticket for sixpence, and you wrote down your estimate. There was a prize for the person whose guess was the closest. 800 people entered the competition, all kinds of people. There were farmers and butchers who you might expect to know this kind of thing. Those were the experts. But there were also all kinds of rabble and riffraff. With the attitude of a typical aristocratic snob, Galton said, quote, "The average competitor was probably as well fitted for making a just estimate of the dressed weight of the ox as an average voter is of judging the merits of most political issues on which he votes." Because of his interest in statistics and because of his prejudices regarding intelligence, Galton decided to conduct a little experiment. When the contest was over, he asked for all the tickets that had been submitted. There were exactly 800 tickets, but 13 were illegible. Galton cut the sample down to the remaining 787. He laid them out in order of the guessed weight. He then took the median, the guess in the very middle, with half of the guesses greater, half of the guesses less. The median guess was 1,207 pounds. The actual weight of the ox, when butchered and dressed, was 1,198 pounds. That's an error of less than 1%. The result hit Galton's anti-democratic, aristocratic, eugenic-prone beliefs pretty hard. He said, "The result seems more creditable to the trustworthiness of a democratic judgment than might have been expected." Galton reported the median of the guesses, the point at which there were as many above as there were below. But he saved all the data, and from that we can figure out something even simpler, the mean, the simple average. And that result's even more amazing. The real weight of the ox, when butchered and dressed, was 1,198 pounds. The average of the guesses for the weight of the ox, the average guess of the assorted rabble with all those non-experts, was 1,197 pounds. That's an error of less than 0.1%. What's the heuristic here? In this case, it's social. When in doubt, go with the mean judgment. When in doubt, rely on the wisdom of crowds. Here's another case along those lines. Remember Regis Philbin and Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? The idea of that show was that people were asked multiple choice questions that got progressively more difficult. If you answered 15 questions in a row, you got $1 million. If a contestant didn't know the answer to a question, they could do one of three things. They could have two of the four options removed, increasing the odds of guessing right. They could call a friend whom they had singled out in advance as one of the smartest people they knew. That's our expert. The third option was to ask the studio audience, with a majority answer polled immediately and electronically. So how well did the experts do in Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? How often did they choose the right answer? They actually did pretty well. The experts picked the correct answer 65% of the time. How well did the studio audience do? They picked the correct answer 91% of the time. Those two examples come from James Surowiecki, a business columnist for The New Yorker. It's not technically the mean, though it is the majority vote. When in doubt, rely on the wisdom of crowds. There are more than just stories behind this heuristic, however. The wisdom of crowds has a simple statistical explanation. The explanation shows why it works, when it works, and when you shouldn't expect it to work. So suppose you're a contestant on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, and you get this question. Which river did Caesar cross? A, the Amazon. B, the Danube. C, the Mississippi. D, the Rubicon. You have no idea of the answer. You could call your expert. The experts were right 65% of the time. Or you can ask for a poll of the studio audience. The audience was right 91% of the time. How can that be? The audience contains all kinds of people, many of whom have totally distorted ideas of who Caesar even was. Many of them are as ignorant as you are. How can a majority vote of that rabble be accurate 91% of the time? Here's how. The audience probably does contain at least a few people who do know the answer. I'll simplify this by taking this to extremes. Suppose that the audience had just two kinds of people. One, people who know the answer, and two, those who are totally ignorant. Take the people who know the answer. They'll pick D, the Rubicon. Now take those who are totally ignorant. If they're totally ignorant, their answers will spread randomly across all four alternatives. That's going to be the key. So let's start by tallying the answers of the ignorant. Those will spread randomly across all four alternatives. Then add the answers from the people who know. Take that answer that got the most votes. What is it? The Rubicon. The statistical phenomenon behind the wisdom of crowds is the fact that the ignorant answers randomize over all possibilities. When we go for the answer that got the most votes, the ignorant answers effectively cancel each other out. That leaves the knowledgeable answers to tip the scale. In that simplification, I assumed that people divided neatly between the ignorant and the knowledgeable. But the explanation stands even if we don't assume that. Suppose that there are people who are more or less knowledgeable, and people who are more or less ignorant. Those who are more or less knowledgeable will hit the right answer more or less. Those who are more or less ignorant will guess randomly more or less, and the effect will be the same. The wisdom of crowds will reflect the degree of wisdom of even a few people in the crowd. That same explanation holds for Galton's ox. There were some people in that crowd who really did know how to estimate the weight of an ox. The rest of the people didn't. But precisely because they didn't, they were as likely to guess too high as to guess too low. When you line up the answers from low to high, the answers of those who really know will end up approximately in the middle. The highs and lows will cancel each other out. That's Galton's median. When you average all the answers, the random highs and lows cancel out, allowing the more knowledgeable answers to shine through. So, statistics explain the effect. They also show when you can rely on it and when you'd better not. Here are the conditions. In order for this to work, you have to have an audience in which there are some people who really do know the answer. A crowd of school children won't outguess Warren Buffett on stock choices. But it's interesting that you don't have to know who the people are who really know. You don't have to be able to identify the experts. All you have to know is that there are some people in that crowd who really do know. The other condition is that the wrong answers have to really be random. It won't work if all the ignorant people have the same kind of ignorance. It won't work if they all think that Mississippi is going to be the answer to all questions about rivers, for example, just because it's hard to spell. Lots of people with lots of different biases is fine. Those are the biases that will cancel each other out. What you don't want is to have all the biases in the same direction. Let's move on to another heuristic, important not for picking answers, but for deciding what to do. In decision making, the ideally rational setup is one in which you examine all courses of action, calculate consequences, compare benefits and losses, and then decide. If you're making an important decision and you have the time, that's what you should do. But the demands of action often preclude that kind of extended consideration. Often the alternatives are too many, and the demands are too immediate. If you're a fireman deciding how to fight a basement fire, you don't have time to be a perfect maximizer. You don't have time to look up the blueprints, map out all possible ways of entry, analyze the probabilities that certain fire-retardant materials were used in construction, access medical records in order to determine the probability that a child on the third floor is asthmatic. The fireman doesn't have time for all that. Lives are at risk, and property's going up fast. We often don't have time to be perfect maximizers. The heuristic to use in these kinds of cases is called satisficing. Pick a realistic set of goals. The fireman's may be these: keep your comrades safe, get everyone out of the building, put the fire out before it spreads to the next building. Now, start looking for a course of action that will achieve those goals, any course of action. Consider alternatives in any order they happen to occur to you. You're not looking for perfection. You're looking for good enough. You're trying to be a satisficer. So the heuristic here, take that first course of action that meets your goals. Go! There's evidence that satisficing is in fact the way firefighters think. There's also biological evidence that it's built into a wide range of animal behavior. Believe it or not, satisficing is often used in computer programs as well. Even computers don't have time to consider all the options in every case. Heuristics are rational shortcuts. Given the selective pressure imposed by the environment, it's not surprising that animals should have some heuristic shortcuts built in. The animal has to do something to shake off the predator and has to do it now. If there's a way of doing that without all the time delay of careful logical calculation, evolution will select for it. Those organisms that have the technique built in will live to reproduce more consistently. So the result is a behavioral heuristic built into the species. We can expect generally successful heuristics to be chosen for, even if they don't work all the time, quick and dirty techniques that evade predators, much of the time, will be selected for, too. People have an evolutionary history. When we look at ourselves, we can expect to find some generally useful heuristics built in. In an earlier lecture, we looked at gut reactions and emotions in this light. Those are part of our behavioral inheritance. Fear is a heuristic for getting out of the way. Disgust is a heuristic for avoidance. The emotions involved in sexual attraction, on the other hand, are telling you something more positive. So, should you try to calculate things rationally, or should you go with your gut? The answer seems to be both. Neither emotions nor gut reactions should be ignored. They have the experience of our ancestors built in. When a decision is of the same type as those made by our ancestors, and it has to be made fast, like getting out of the way of an approaching stampede, extended calculation is clearly a bad idea. Go with your gut. On the other hand, our rationality is also a major part of our evolutionary inheritance. If it hadn't been good for anything, we wouldn't have it. Rational calculation is going to be particularly useful where a decision is long range, where it doesn't have to be made immediately. In that case, we should use all of our resources, survey all available information, and weigh all options carefully. To rely on gut reactions and emotions alone might well be to make the wrong decision. Rational deliberation is also going to be particularly important when the decisions we face are not the same as those faced by our ancestors. Evolution hasn't had time to catch up with the need to make presentations before one's business partners, for example. It hasn't had time to catch up with the internet and cell phones. Business partners aren't as hazardous as predators. They won't literally eat you. If your system is recruiting a heuristic appropriate to predators, then it's recruiting the wrong heuristic. Rationality should override it. Cell phones and internet access are not as important as the food you need for tomorrow. If your system reacts to losing them as if it were a matter of literal survival, it's recruiting the wrong heuristic. Rationality should override. Not all heuristics are built in. Some can be deliberately acquired. Here's a lesson on acquired heuristics from one of the great thinkers, Noémie Janos. I put him near the top of my list of the smartest people of the 20th century. Born in Hungary in 1903, he changed his name to John von Neumann by the time he came to America. He made major advances in set theory, in number theory, and in computer science. He basically invented game theory, which we'll talk about later. He was a major mover in the Manhattan Project, responsible for the atomic bomb in World War II, in the later hydrogen bomb, and in the early years of the Atomic Energy Commission. Along with Einstein, he was one of the original members of the Institute for Advanced Studies at Princeton. And all of our computers embody what's known as the von Neumann architecture. The interesting thing about von Neumann is that he quite deliberately built his own kit of heuristics. It was that kit of heuristics that let him cross fields so easily and productively, from physics and mathematics to economics to game theory. I'm sure you've seen technical textbooks with lists of formulae in the back, always a little forbidding. We go to them only when we have to. Not von Neumann. Those were von Neumann's favorite part. He would deliberately memorize the formulae in the back of textbooks, formulae in matrix arithmetic, formulae in physics, formulae in theoretical biology, formulae in economics. Why? So that he could use those patterns as heuristics. In particular, so that he could recognize similar patterns elsewhere. In the history of ideas, it's repeatedly happened that an idea in one area developed for one purpose finds an unexpected application elsewhere. Concepts developed purely for philosophy of mathematics turned out to be just what you needed to build a computer. Statistical formulae developed for understanding genetic change in biology are now applied in both economics and in programming. Von Neumann's strategy was to familiarize himself with those formal patterns in order to be able to see connections and analogies when he saw something like them somewhere else. He stocked up on mental patterns in one place so he could apply them somewhere else. Now, I'm not arguing that we should all be von Neumanns, nor am I urging you to memorize the backs of technical textbooks. The lesson's much more general and applies to a well-rounded education in literature and the humanities as well. Pay attention to patterns and templates, patterns of reasoning, templates for decision-making, ways of life. Tuck them away for future reference. Those may come in handy in some other context. What I want you to take home from this lecture are two fast and frugal heuristics that allow you to squeeze knowledge from ignorance. One's the recognition heuristic. Remember San Diego and San Antonio. The other's the wisdom of crowds. Remember Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. Now, remember satisficing, a decision heuristic where you need to move fast, set reasonable criteria, and take the first option that's good enough. Trust emotions for the short-term contexts that they're made for. For long-range decisions, you'd better use your head as well as your gut. In this lecture, I've emphasized the sunny side of conceptual patterns, but there's a dark side too, a dark side you can see in some of the mistakes we make. We'll talk about those in the next lecture. Oh yes, at the beginning I mentioned one of Einstein's early papers on a heuristic point of view concerning the generation and transformation of light. I noted that he used the term heuristic to indicate how sketchy and incomplete the work was. That was the paper for which he received the Nobel Prize.